To see examples of what we talk about on this episode, along with further information, go to bunchofdorks.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to
Two Dimension Podcast,
the comic book podcast
with no direction.
When they come, and they will, they'll come for you.
I have an army.
We have a Hulk.
You're listening to Two Dimension, the comic book podcast with no direction. My name is Don Moore, and sitting across from me is a man that demands commodified starlets, Al Val.
I do, but I never get many. But you know, it only takes one or two, and then you're good. But yeah, and we're starting the comic book podcast with no direction, with absolutely no direction, because we've got nothing. We're just gonna wing it. This is gonna be like performance art, and here it goes.
Yeah, it's. Oh, there's a lot of times Al and I start a show, and he says, "I don't have a ready thing. I haven't either. Let's just do a show." For some reason, we always pop in, but it's been raining like no tomorrow the past, 3-4 weeks here?
Which, and it stopped for a while, and then today, really.
Yeah. And, I mean, I'm thankful for the rain because I don't want to go through a drought, and we live on a peninsula. If we don't get enough rain, we sink, and that's a drag. But it's just been constantly raining. I mean, I've kind of enjoyed it. It's fun if I'm home and it rains and I can watch TV. But I'm out in it all the time, and, you know, I'm always soaking, and I started realizing it's really keeping you busy, not realizing it.
You know what they say, rainy days and Mondays always bring me down. Me and the Carpenters. But anyway, we digress. So are there any comic books that you've read at all lately? I know you said something about an Avengers and Defenders book that you picked up at the Comic Book Emporium recently that was by Alan Davis, who's doing a lot more work now, I guess, than he was in the past.
Well, what Al's talking about, I went to Wilson's Book World, and I just picked up a new issue. It's called Captain Britain.
I might have to get that.
The Mighty Defenders. The Mighty Defenders.
That really looks neat.
Who's at the very back page, it says he wrote it, Ewing.
Okay, let me look here. Al Ewing.
Okay. I would have said Patrick Ewing, but...
Yeah, Patrick Ewing.
But, and Alan Davis, you know, of course, penciled it, and Mark Farmer inked it. But Alan Davis had a 3-issue series of the Avengers recently, and he didn't write it. I don't know if the Ewing man had written it. But I loved the art, but I didn't really care for the story so much. On this one, again, Alan Davis, I see it, I pick it up. But this one, I enjoyed more. But I'm guessing this is tying into Marvel Secret Wars.
It is? Okay.
I never read Secret Wars. I never knew anything about it, except I guess they're on some planet and they're all supposed to fight. But this one, all the characters are different. They're modifications of you know, Spider-Man and, you know, Captain Britain and everything else. But which, you know, a lot of these books, that's what you read, is, you know, different versions of stuff. But I guess they're talking about God Doom. Dr. Doom became a god, and he's running the place, and I guess there's a wall between another group of people, and it comes down. So, and I don't know. I really enjoyed it.
But you know what he did? If you take a look at it real close, I'm looking at it, I'm going like, It looks like Farmer simplified, somebody simplified their work a little bit. Maybe it was Davis, but it could have been Farmer too. For some reason, possibly because of the coloring, you know, maybe they simplified the line work because it was getting lost. But it looks a little bit different. I still like it, but I think I like that. The one that I really liked was the Avengers. I mean, the X-Men one that looks like it went back to the late 60s.
With the Hulk,
yeah. I really like the art on that. That's nice. I'm gonna pick it up because I like the Defenders, but is that really... It's not really the Defenders from the 70s,
no,
is it?
No, She-Hulk's in it, and the woman in the white with a sword is Captain Britain. But on this, I guess this dimension or whatever it is, you know, the old Captain Britain stories was... He was on a motorcycle accident. I don't know, he was running away from the Hive or AIM or whatever was, you know, the group at the time, bad group. But the college student was supposed to choose between the sword and the amulet and to get out of this mess. It was two spirits. I think Merlin and, you know, his daughter showed up or something. And or King Arthur, I don't know who it was, but he said he's not a warrior, he's a scholar, so he chose the medallion and became Captain Britain. And this one, I guess obviously they chose the sword. And the Spider-Man character is kind of neat because it's Spider-Man, but its eyes are a little more designed, a little more.
Yeah, it's a little bit, the spider mask is a little different.
Yeah, it's a little more flair to it. And he's got a cape, and it's Batman's cape with a Spider-Man, you know, webbing. It's the Prowler.
Oh,
and,
okay.
In the comic book, it just shows for a second that, I guess, Spider-Man dies, and the Prowler feels bad, so he takes on the Spider-Man mantle.
What's the deal with this iron, weird-looking Iron Man thing?
Well, it has a character, you know, in the Iron Man movie. I don't think there's ever in the comics. When Tony Stark was stuck in that stave in Afghanistan, there was that other doctor there, and they basically got together and built the Iron Man suit, and Tony Stark busted out and was going to help the guy get out. Well, in this book, they tell that story, and Tony Stark built the suit, but then he didn't put it on. He had the doctor put it on. And the doctor's like, no, I can't. And he says, you've got to, because all I've ever done is build arms and stuff. I've hurt the world. The world needs to heal. You need to get out safe. This is no way both of us can get out. So the doctor was completely against it, but he put on a suit and went out. And then it's exactly what Tony Stark said. He built this empire, but it's nothing but healing and helping people. And his daughter is in this Iron Man suit now. He's got one, too. I thought that was kind of neat, you know. And it had that whole thing to it, but then you start looking at it, it's like the whole society's too controlled. And, again, they keep talking about God doom, and there's certain things you can't say because, you know, it's almost like a communist state or something like that, or like 1984.
Okay.
And, so I don't know, it was kind of a neat story. It's kind of unfolding. I didn't realize it was a Secret Wars thing because I had no interest in reading it. But
does it say, oh yeah, in the bottom line, yeah, it says Secret Wars.
Well, like I said, when I started reading about behind the walls these other people, and I thought, oh okay, they're setting it up for that, I guess. But nevertheless, I'll read this book because I really like Alan Davis and it was fun.
Yeah, it looks fun. I mean, it looks kind of like a real comic book as opposed to some of the other ones that
yeah,
kind of look like
yeah,
real comic books.
Like I said, Alan Davis is one of those
I
see what he gets and I just pick it up. You know?
Yeah, well, I'm glad he's still doing a lot of work, and it's inked by Mark Farmer, so it's the usual, you know, team of guys that work well together. I actually like Mark Farmer's inks when he was working over, what's his face, on the Fantastic Four. Oh, I'm so bad at names right now.
You mentioned him before. Is the one you thought was
Bagley? Like, Bagley.
Oh, Bagley. No,
when he was thinking on Mark Bagley when before the FF was canceled, the new FF or whatever it was, I thought it was really good. So, Mark Farmer definitely adds a lot to the book. But yeah, I heard the Fantastic Four movie just came out, and supposedly everybody's bagging on it or whatever. You know, I just can't believe that they can't get that movie right. You know, such a great book, such a great concept, and they keep screwing it up every time. You put it out in the theaters, you know, it's a shame.
You and I talked about a long time ago. I don't care for comic book movies. I went to see Ant-Man, and I really
liked
it.
You did?
Yeah.
You liked it?
I was surprised. You know, when Iron Man came out, I had no interest, but everybody kept talking about it, and I heard it. I thought, man, this kind of sounds like a fun movie. I wanted to go see it. And my wife, we're going to go to the movies. What do you want to see? And when I said Iron Man, she just gave me this stone look like she had no interest. And then later, my daughter, I said something to her. And she said my line, I don't like superhero movies. Okay. Well, you know, I ended up buying it on DVD, and my daughter watched it with me. She loved it. You know, I liked it. But there was just something about Ant-Man watching the trailers. It looked fun. It looked like a fun movie, and I always kind of liked Ant-Man. And so I thought, all right, I'll check it out. And when I told my wife, I want to go to the movies, she goes, what are you going to see? And I said, Ant-Man. And I was waiting for the old reaction, and she said, oh, yeah. And we went, and we walked out, and she said, that was fun. It was like a real movie. And I guess that's the thing. A lot of the superhero movies, even if they're fine movies, they're all kind of cookie cutter. You know, when I say the script is different stuff, but it just always seems manufactured, and it's like you kind of got to see the other movie to appreciate this one. Iron Man was a self-contained movie. Now, they mentioned things in the Avengers. They mentioned, you know, it's kind of neat. It starts out with Hank Pym, and Kirk Douglas plays him. And he goes...
No, Michael Douglas.
Yeah, Michael Douglas, sorry. Michael Douglas plays him. And then he hides the technology because he doesn't want Tony Stark's father to get a hold of it because, you know, he turns everything into weapons. Well, then it switches to now. And, you know, Michael Douglas is an older man, and he lost control of his company. They kind of, when I say cookie cutter, though, they kind of took the Iron Man script a little bit because, you know, the other guy running the company is the one that becomes the arch nemesis and stuff. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, so it is, but it was fun. I like, my wife enjoyed a lot of laughing. There's a lot of fun parts to it. It was in San Francisco, which is my favorite city, and they wrote in the Scott Lang character who became Iron, you know, the whole prison thing. But it was fun, and parts of it reminded me of those old 70s kind of cop shows where they have like a little team of, you know, crazy wild guys and stuff, you know.
You mean like the streets of San Francisco?
Yeah,
with
stuff.
Michael Douglas and
yeah,
Scott
or,
Walden.
You know, just, it was fun, and it was neat, and...
To me, it was just like, I remember, you remember the old Saturday Night Live sketch with all the superheroes, right? They were making fun of Ant-Man.
And you know, Garrett Morris was in the Ant-Man movie.
I heard he's in the movie.
And
yeah.
I had to explain to my wife later why he was in that, because she knows him. He's on a show now called Two Broke Girls.
Oh, he's on that?
Yeah. And I said he was on Saturday Night Live. On the Facebook page, somebody posted the Saturday Night Live sketch. Might have been me, actually. But, yeah, the Garrett Morrison. After that, everybody made fun of Ant-Man for years and
yeah,
years.
Yeah, sure, yeah. Well, I mean, he wasn't that great. Hank Pym was Ant-Man, but then he became Giant-Man, right? Is that how the
Yeah,
how
like the four or five issues in
yeah.
the Avengers.
And then Janet was the Wasp. That was his wife or whatever.
And then later he became the Yellow Jacket.
I forgot about that. Okay, yeah, so he was a lot of different
And then
guys.
There was Goliath, and I think Goliath was actually Hawkeye. I'm not sure, but I think Goliath was Hawkeye that used Pym particles to get big and became Goliath.
Oh, I forgot about
that's
that.
That's when I'm guessing around the time, no, it was right before he became Wasp or Yellow Jacket.
Because I remember buying as a kid in the 60s, buying like Avengers 34, and I remember, I don't know if they called him Goliath or Giant Man, but I remember that cover. It was a really nice Don Heck cover. It was a really nicely drawn Don Heck book, and I remember
he was in a red suit with the mask.
I think he was in a yellow suit, a yellow and blue suit, if I remember correctly. He wasn't the red one yet. I'm getting confused.
Because the Giant Man suit, the original Giant Man suit, it was just the Ant-Man suit without the helmet and the little gas particle pellets
on
the front.
It was a different suit.
Yeah, well, I guess Hawkeye was Goliath, and he had like these heavy metal belts, and like a harness on his chest, and his mask was cut at the top, so his blonde hair was sticking out of it. You know, I don't really know. And then there was another guy, Black Goliath.
yeah, DC.
That was Marvel too.
Wasn't
it
Marvel?
70s.
Okay, DC had what was their
Colossal
character?
Boy.
There was Black Lightning too.
Oh yeah, yeah.
That was a DC one.
I liked that comic. The first issue when it came out.
They're gonna bring him back, you know. I don't know.
He never went away. He was with the Outsiders of Batman, and he seemed like
that's
he
right.
always comes back. But I think Tony DiNizuniga, didn't he
I
draw
thought Trevor Von Eden did those. Do you remember the name Trevor?
Yeah, yeah, he did do it. But I think Tony DiNizuniga or somebody had something to do with it.
Yeah, who knows? There were so many interchangeable artists back then.
No, but that was that first issue especially I really liked. And everybody made fun of Black Lightning because I guess his mask had the afro attached to it. It was like an afro wig with that mask.
I didn't know that.
And so, you know, he was a school teacher, but when you put the mask on, you have
a fro.
A little bit more of a fro.
That's awesome.
Well, it's, you know, it was a book I enjoyed. It had a lot of heart and said a lot of things, and you know, like I said, he came back to Batman and the Outsiders. He was one of the main characters, and I guess he could shock, I guess, but he's mostly a fist fighter, the way I always took it in the old books. And I guess the shocks were just kind of like a minor thing, but later with Batman and the Outsiders, I guess the shocks were a little more heavy.
Yeah.
But anyway.
He didn't have too much of a shelf life, Black Lightning, maybe like 9-10 issues or something.
Yeah, but the character still seems to keep coming back somehow.
Huh.
You know?
I don't remember ever seeing him except for Batman and the Outsider. You're probably right.
Yeah, I haven't either, but I do think he's still around.
And there was a Power Man for Marvel, all those guys. I'm surprised he hasn't made a comeback. Power Man, Power Man and Iron Fist, that would be a cool movie. All kung fu and action and stuff like that.
Yeah, Power Man kind of, I don't know how long he lasted, but
he used to always say... 50 issues of Power Man and Iron Fist.
Hero for Hire.
Hero for Hire, yeah. Yeah. Luke Cage, Hero for Hire, yeah.
But he used to always say, Sweet Christmas. Sweet Christmas!
Oh, man.
But no, he kind of went away. No, the book was still there, but then they were both in a Marvel team-up that Clarice Claremont and John Byrne drew. And it was Iron Fist, and then later Power Man, and then Daughters of the Dragon, the other two ladies that were in Iron Fist. And then...
That would be a cool movie.
And then they brought it back as Power Man and Iron Fist together. Yeah, that one, and that was a popular comic. They were a good team.
That would be. Are you hearing me, Hollywood people out there? Iron Fist, Power Man, and they have the Daughters of the Dragon. You have the Kung Fu guys.
I think they.
You have the black and white, and you got the Kung Fu chicks all fighting and stuff. That would be awesome.
I think Power Man's one of those Netflix shows, maybe.
I don't even get Netflix anymore. I know Hawkeye is and Daredevil is. I'd like to see Iron Fist and Power Man though.
Yeah, I don't too.
And then maybe they get Daughters of the Dragon and the White Tiger. All the Kung Fu guys, you know what I mean? Just kicking and all that stuff. That'd be amazing. That'd be an amazing Netflix series. Anybody out there with the power,
bring back Luke Cage. I bought the first issue. It was in the 90s when Ghost Rider was so big and Wolverine and Punisher were the three big characters from Marvel. Which I, at the time, found really strange. But they had a book. It was called Cage. And he didn't look anything like Iron Fist. I mean, Power Man. He didn't have that steel tiara, or the yellow open shirt with the chain belt.
That's awesome.
And he just looked like a regular guy in the streets wearing tennis shoes and a grimace on his face. And I bought the book, but I didn't really remember too much about it. I was reading them.
Fight off the stands or in a comic
shop? Yeah, I bought it at Food Lion.
Food Lion. I've been a Food Lion before.
But they had there was a write-up in Comic Scene magazine or something, and the guy was, I guess the writer was talking about Cage and what's happened to him and why he was mad and something about him and Danny Rand, who was Iron Fist, and I guess he said something about Danny did something and what Luke Cage is doing to deal with it and stuff, and I don't know if the book really lasts. I bought the first issue and I was interested because I did read those books before. But, and I thought it was kind of cool they were changing the character so much. Even though he didn't really look a superhero anymore, but...
Did the Food Lion have a spinner rack?
No, when you walked in the store, they had, like where they had the candy. And on the very end of the aisle of candy, they had a rack with, comic books in it.
Like a magazine.
Yeah, but it was just those little wire holders. And it held, I think, four or five high. It didn't have a lot, but it had some,
So when your mom went to do shopping, you'd get out of
No, this is me. I had a little kid,
Okay.
We went to Food Lion one day, and I looked in, and I bought a couple of books. I bought that Iron Man, I think I bought, Cage, and I think I bought I don't know.
This was in the 70s.
90s. This is like 97.
No, I'm talking about... Oh, you bought it at the Food Lion in the 90s?
Yeah.
I thought it was the Food Lion in the 70s or something.
No.
Oh.
No, Cage. This is in the 90s.
So when you went to Oklahoma, you bought it in...
Here in Florida. Here in town.
Where's our Food Lion here?
This is in the 90s.
There was that chain. Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
All right, the history of Food Lion here in Pinellas County, the Tampa Bay area. They started advertising in the 80s. We didn't have a Food Lion, but I think they opened one up in 89. And it was right in this shopping center. It was Food Lion, Farmore, which is no longer there anymore.
Oh, I love Farmore.
And
what a great
they place. Were both there. Food Lion was really popular. And then...
Where was this at? What part?
On 66th Street, where the Harbor Freight is? The Harbor Freight store across
from
Kmart?
No, but I got a feeling that, is it 66th Street, around the...
Across from the Kmart on 66th Street.
Yeah, I know where it is.
Right. Yeah, that's where it was. Farm War is where Harbor Freight
exactly
was.
Where it is, yeah.
And then next to that was Food Line. And what killed it was sometime in the early 90s, 2020, did a story about Food Line and how they were using bleach or ammonia on their beef. I guess if the beef got, I didn't see the thing, but all of a sudden Food Line was going down the tubes. And there's some woman I work with, I used to see her at Food Line once in a while. And I saw, she was no longer working at the place I was at, but she saw me in some store. And while we're talking, she says, well, I'll see you around. I still go to Food Line, she said. And my wife went a couple of times. When I told her, I said, what happened? And she said, oh, it's 2020. And I guess Food Line was still around in other places, but
sure it was.
They disappeared. They were all over Jacksonville, Florida. They were all over here. And then they all just vanished, you know.
In the early 2000s, I was up in the Carolinas, and they had Food Lions there.
Yeah,
maybe they're gone by now. But
they had them in Louisiana, too.
So it would have been a promising competition to the Winn-Dixie and Publix, but they bleached their burgers and they,
Something about meat, beef, and huh. I think something about, I guess they got too old to sell and they bleach it, you know. I don't know exactly how they do it, but it wasn't legal, and when 2020 showed it, they...
Was it John Stossel?
I didn't see it. I don't know
anything
about it.
Okay.
So anyway, that's a grocery store history with Don and
Al. I remember Farm War because I used to buy all my videos, a lot of sell-through videos there.
Man, that was a great store.
It was a great store.
And it just got bigger and bigger. And that was the thing everybody's talking about was,
it was.
When you want to buy a CD, the best thing to go is to go to Farm War. And if they don't have it, then you go to these other places. But Farm War was the first place you hit.
And it was cheaper, I think, right?
It was a lot cheaper.
Yeah.
And it was so much fun because when VHS tape was there, they had...
Yep.
They had a bunch of movies, and I mean, it was fun, you know, just movies you remember as a kid, and, you know, just oddball movies you saw, and it was just a blast to go through Farm War.
It was the first place where I remember, like, the B movies that I love were cheaper. They were, like, in the $9 or $10 range, so I could buy them. They made them affordable. Before that, they were, like, $50 and $60, and all you could do was, like, copy them. Now you go to Farm War and get Dracula vs. Frankenstein, or, you know, or... A lot of those titles that are up there, like Horror of the Blood Monsters or, you know, Inframan or whatever, you can get it for $10. And then they went out of business, damn it, like in the late 90s, maybe, they went out of business.
But they were extremely
popular.
They were
strong.
Store. Yeah, they were strong and popular.
They were all over the place, too. Yeah. I mean, they had them, like, in every little strip mall.
Well, they were advertising them here before we had one. I thought Farm More was some kind of gas station or something. And then when they opened up, my wife always went and says, man, you're getting all this stuff. And, you know, it was a drugstore kind of grocery store. And I'd go, man, this is, and it just, again, they just got better and better and better. And, I don't know what happened, but.
You know what happened, too, what they were good at, too, is before that, like, blank video was really expensive. They were the one of the first that kind of got the prices down lower. So I could start recording more movies and I can actually afford it. You know, before that it was like $10 for one VHS, and then after like in the early 90s, their stuff went down. You can get like four VHSs for $10. So you could say, hey, I can record four movies on SP, the good speed, and like, you know, it'll be in good shape forever. So
yeah.
You know, they did that, and then, you know, like all good things, they went away, you know. So it's like, you know, oh well, what are you going to do? All right, let's play some music.
Okay.
Thank you. You can hear our most recent 20 episodes on iTunes. If you would like to hear our older episodes, you can find them on our blog. Just go to bunchofdorks.com and click on the Cyclops.
And that was Ice Water, which was an early version of the band Big Star before Alex Chilton came into the picture with All I See Is You from 1971.
But what happened to the singer on this song, if Alex Chilton came on?
He died, Chris Bell. Big Star was a, I guess they were kind of like a Beatle-ish band, kind of English and British Invasion band, but they started in the early 70s, and they had they were more, you know, back in the early 70s, everything was getting heavy, Zeppelin, or Prog, yes, or Genesis, or King Crimson, so the pop, you know, the power pop, or what the Beatles did around the time of Revolver or whatever, was kind of like, I don't know if it was passé, but it wasn't done that much. This is a kind of a band that went back to that thing. And Chris Bell, which was the original, the guy who, you know, came up with the idea for him, this band, and then Alex Chilton, who had been in the Box Tops but quit or whatever, was just like, you know, around Memphis doing things and, you know, just hanging out. And they asked him to join, and they kind of became like a prototypical band for like bands that came after, like REM and the DBs and stuff like that. So, you know, but Chris Bell left after the first album, the first Big Star album. And, you know, he ran a family business, and like he died in 78 or whatever, and Chilton went on. And, you know, the thing about Big Star was, the interesting about them was they started out as a British Invasion, kind of like pop, power pop band or whatever. And then, like, after the first album, Chris Bell, the guy who sings on this song, left because he thought that, like, Alex Chilton was getting all the notoriety and it was more his band or whatever. So Chilton took over the band, and then they kind of morphed into something. The second album, which is called Radio City, was kind of like a rock record. It was a rock. It was more rock, but it had some kind of, like, weird edges to it or whatever. But it had some great songs in it. By the time of the third record, it was only Alex Chilton and the drummer, and that, like, Big Star's third is a great, messed up, drugged out, weirdo record that you need to listen to. So, anyway, that's a lot of introduction for Ice Water. Ice Water is the beginning of Big Star. So, anyway, let's play. Since we don't have anything planned, we're going to come back to the old favorite that we just started which is called, what's it called? Polapalooza.
Polapalooza.
Right? Polapalooza, where I brought out a bag of comics.
Yeah. Sorry, we're not going to talk about grocery store history
anymore. No. We're not going to talk. Well, maybe next time, you know. But anyway, I'm gonna give this to you, and you pull out a comic book. Ooh. Oh, yeah. I think we've talked about that, but that's Gulliver Jones, isn't it?
Yeah, okay. The last time we did Polapalooza, I pulled out A Creature of the Loose, and Al said, is that a Gulliver Jones issue, which I had no idea. And when I was putting the show together and I found the cover to Creatures in the Loose that we talked about, the next issue was Gulliver Jones. Yeah, and Creatures in the Loose, the only way I knew it was the old timely Atlas, you know, monster comics that I like so much. But I've never heard of Gulliver Jones. It's got a Gil Kane cover, like most of the comics that Marvel did.
Yeah, really.
And boy, he could do some covers. Yeah. So anyway, tell us about Gulliver Jones, Warrior of Mars.
You know, he's like a John Carter type of guy, you know? I mean, yeah, he was kind of like, Roy Thomas. Well, look at this, man. Roy Thomas, Gil Kane, Bill Everett inking it.
Wow.
And then on the back, I think it's got like a Jack Kirby, Dick Ayers classic, The Frightened Man. So this is a great comic book. You need to go out and buy this and ask your local comic book shop to get it. He was like a Warlord of Mars. He was kind of like a John Carter thing, because that was, you know, there was, you know, all the ERB stuff was getting DC was putting out all the Edgar Rice Burroughs stuff or whatever. So he, you know, they just started doing this, and I guess it's based on, let's see, it says here, freely adapted from the novel Lieutenant Gulliver Jones by Edwin L. Arnold. So I guess it was an old pulp thing, maybe from the 50s or the 40s or something like that. But it's a cool little book, you know. I mean, I probably read it a long time ago. That copy is Steve Tatum's, because he signed the cover. Wherever you are, Steve, I have your beat up, dog eared copy of Creatures on the Loose. But those books are a lot of fun, man. And you're right, every book in the early 70s had a Gil Kane cover. Even though I believe I read somewhere that Stan Lee didn't like Gil Kane's art.
Yeah, we talked about it in the past.
He liked his covers, though.
Well, no, he didn't.
Did Stan lay them out, too? The covers?
I don't think Stan laid them out. I think John Romita laid the covers out. I think Stan, what he was saying on those Conan books with Roy Thomas was what elements you should show on the comic. And then, you know, like I said, I think John Romita was the one laying all the covers out, and the artist would follow him. Because, again, what they had was Conan fighting that dragon on the cover. But, yeah, I think Stanley liked Gil Kane fine and all that. He just didn't think that he fit with Marvel. It's what Roy Thomas is saying. But when Stan basically went to the West Coast and Roy took over, Roy used Gil Kane. Gil Kane was one of the most Marvel artists of all. You know?
Yeah, he was one of the most marvelous artists of them all. Yeah, I don't know what Stan's problem was. I guess maybe he thought he was too much of a DC guy.
I don't think it was a problem. I think it's just everybody has their own taste and aesthetics. How many times have you read that where an art director just didn't care for somebody's work, and then now an art director leaves and somebody else takes over? And,
yep.
You know, well, Carmen Infantino didn't really like Kirby's work.
And Shooter never liked Colin's work.
Yeah, or other people.
Other people, yeah, right.
But that's, no, but, I mean, sometimes it's like the four of us to do this show, and every one of us have different things. Like, I really like Dave Cockrum. He's one of my favorites.
Yeah.
But there's this short window of really loving Dave Cockrum. You know, I didn't like what he turned into. Dallas doesn't care. But yet, a lot of artists that came on X-Men and later, Dallas loves that. I mean, I think they're fine. I just don't really, you know, go crazy over them.
Dallas doesn't like the Who either, so.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know what that's all about, but
yeah, it's hard for me to imagine, but, you know, everybody has artists in rock bands that they like, and others don't, and that's all okay.
No, it's not. Not yet is okay. You have to like the Beatles. I'm sorry. You know, I remember back in the 70s, some kid, this is the first time I ever heard this, he was like, oh, man, I don't like the Beatles. I like Blondie. And I'm like, huh?
Well, it's,
I like Blondie, too, but, I mean, come on. Yeah. I like them both. Yeah, but...
My first roommate in college, he didn't like the Beatles, and that's my favorite band, and I can't stand the Beatles. And he didn't like Yes either, and that was the two things I listened to all the time.
What did he like? Like Zeppelin or like Ozzy or whatever?
No. He liked stuff they played on Top 40. He was a big Linda Ronstadt fan.
Oh, okay.
And he liked other bands. He, you know, he had Pink Floyd's The Wall. Basically, whatever was in the Top 40, he'd pick up. And he had, you know, he and I had some of the same albums. And then, you know, like I said, some albums he couldn't stand. Yes, he hated the Beatles. What I always thought was funny was he had a lot of the solo work of the Beatles. He had George Harrison. He had Ringo Starr. He had some Paul McCartney. He didn't like John Lennon.
Okay.
But no, I don't know. It was always kind of odd, I thought. But, you know, it's what makes the world interesting.
And my next question is, when you were in college, what supermarket did you shop at? Was it Food Lion?
No, there was no Food Lions out there. All right, I was in college in Abilene, Texas, and right by the school, believe it or not, they had a grocery store called Super Duper.
Super Duper?
And everybody made fun of it. But then they had a Safeway.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
They had, I can't think of what, there was another grocery store in another part of town. It was.
Did they have comic books? That's the other question.
No.
When you were in college, did you actually buy comic books at all?
Oh, yeah. I never stopped buying comics.
There was a comic shop nearby?
No. There wasn't any comic store in Abilene, Texas at all.
Oh, sorry.
There was a drug store, I'm told, close to the university. Well, yeah, they did. I never went to it, but they had comics. I went in a couple of times. And some convenience stores in town had them, but a lot of them didn't. And so I rarely bought comics in town. I just wait till I went home in that store I went to in Oklahoma City.
Oh, you bought a bunch of them.
Yeah, he'd hold them for me.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I forgot about that. Yeah.
But no, I don't know about now, but when I went to college, Abilene, Texas didn't.
So you'd come back to school with a box full of a whole bunch load of
books. No, I'd read them when I was at home on vacation.
Oh, so you didn't have that many comic books in your dorm room or anything like that?
I didn't at first. I had some, but I was afraid they'd get trashed because everybody was trashing everything in the dorm. But, you know, my second year, I had some. I always had a stack.
Oh, okay, that's good. But, did you buy music when you were in college? Did you buy albums or you were buying cassettes?
I bought albums. I had some cassettes, but money. It's just...
Yeah, money was low, yeah.
You know, basically I get a couple for Christmas and then, you know...
And you play the hell out of them.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And that was it. All right, let me pull one.
Well, this Creatures Loose, one thing I think is neat was I really loved all the reprints, and even though Gulliver Jones is in the front, it still has two reprints in it, which is nice.
That's a really nice cover, too. I'm wondering who inked it. It doesn't look like Gil Kane inked it, but he might have.
Well, somebody wrote everything on the inside. They wrote Gil Kane cover. Maybe they wrote inks.
Yeah, this guy wrote it here. I guess he figured that we couldn't read it on the, you know, the front there or whatever, but yeah. Well, the Kirby stuff isn't you know, signed or anything like that, but I think we know.
Yeah.
I think we know Jack Kirby's work, and of course Steve actually wrote his name on both sides in case you forgot.
Well, that's, you know,
Steve Tatum's book or whatever.
But I'm guessing this Gulliver Jones, that was licensed then.
It was a book.
Yeah.
Unless it was a PD book, but. Everett's inking looks good on this.
Bill Everett was a really good artist.
It really does. It's really nice. I mean, it fits his work better than I think the stuff he inked Kirby around this time, but it looks really good. And here's like...
Inked Barry Smith, too.
Yeah, he did a Conan, didn't he?
Yeah.
Or was it no Avengers? I think it was Avengers.
No, he inked Conan for a while.
Here's what... You know, we're going to go off topic again, folks, but I'm sorry, you know. I never joined this. But I just looked through this, and I'm going like, wow. How many great albums did the Columbia Record Club have in 1971? Look at that.
Mm-hmm.
Every one of these records is great. You got, like, Sweet Baby James by James Taylor, Bridge Over Troubled Water, Three Dog Night, Iron Butterfly, and Got It To Be. Did you ever join this thing?
No. Me and you and Des talked about this one episode.
It's just like, look through it, and I'm like, James Gang's third or whatever. I thought you got the Beatles. Oh, you got it as a gift, the Beatles, Meet the Beatles, as a record.
Okay, yeah, when I was 3 years old, we lived in Utah, and my parents had another couple that were good friends of theirs, they were in a record club, and Mom and Dad would get records with them through the record club. It was always country, and they always had the record of the month, and Meet the Beatles was the record of the month, and it came in. They didn't put it in order, so it showed up, and they didn't want it. And instead of sending it back, they just gave it to me because I was always trying to sing the Beatles songs at 3 years old. And I was so happy. I listened to that thing. I still have it, but you can't play it, you know. And it's almost like it's like in that movie The Time Machine, the old George Powell movie, when the guy picks up the books and it turned to dust, you know. And the grooves in the record, you can almost see through it because I just listened to it so much.
So as a 3-year-old, you had your own record player, or you played it in your dad's record player?
My parents, yeah. Okay. And there was one point we didn't have a record player, and any time I went to somebody's house, I'd bring it with me. Can I use your record player?
You do like a little Beatle air guitar thing or something?
No,
like that?
Okay. No, I would just sit wherever, floor wherever by the record player, and I just listen intently.
The thing about it is, I'm looking through all these albums here, and I'm like, music... What happened, man? Why you suck so much these days?
I can't say that. There's good music.
There's good music by Steve Robinson and people like that. For the most part, Main Street popular music sucks. At me, sucks whatever.
I think a lot of it, though, was the Beatles fueled everything. And even after the Beatles were gone, it just kept going. And
they did.
Basically, they just left it alone. They let the musicians do what they like to do, and they put it out. Now, it seemed like everybody has to control everything.
Everybody's saying things more controlled. Like back then, musicians were more experimental. They would take more chances.
And the record companies would just try out things and leave it there. Now it's like they want to make sure they get heavy returns on everything.
I think the problem, too, is today music is more accessible in a lot of ways, but it's less... It's more accessible, but it's more difficult to find, too, because you don't really know. There's no common place where everybody goes to listen to their music. It's all, like, all over the place, and you got to, like, you know, look around. But I mean, when you look at mainstream rock and roll from 1971, you know, nowadays you look at mainstream rock and roll or rock or whatever, it's like, music, you suck really bad today.
To us.
Right. Yeah, I think to everybody.
All right, Pullapalooza 2.
Let me get this one here.
And the Mighty Karnak says...
Oh, okay. House of Secrets from D.C. Yep, gotta love them. Bernie Wrightson cover when he was great.
Yeah.
With all the, you know, back in 19... well, I think we're hitting 1971 hard. Is it 71 or 73? Okay, wow, beautiful. Beautiful. House of Secrets number 107. Beautiful. Alfred Alcala story here. Well, Bernard Bailey story. Bernard Bailey, wasn't he like the Spectre?
The guy that created Spectre with Jerry Siegel.
Wow, look at that. And I'll tell you, this gives me a good reason to bring up a topic, too. You got two Alfred Alcala with like some ugly-looking horror guy there or whatever.
But that looks really old. That doesn't look like the Alfredo Alcala that I saw.
This is like the 1973 Alfredo Alcala. Here's an interesting... Ooh. And this next story about Alfredo Alcala is written by one of my favorite writers, Arnold Dragan. It's called Night of the Nebbish. That's pretty funny. Anyway, here's an interesting comment that a cool guy that goes on my Destination Nightmare blog and does some comments on it, who's a really... I know him as his blog is JMR777, so he's a real cool guy. He likes he likes a lot of the short story horror like I do, you know, and then the horror mags or whatever. And I mentioned to him, and you can testify to this or whatever, vouch for this, that again, going back to the days, you know, before kids were on my lawn, we used to go to comic shops to buy our books or convenience stores, and I remember personally as a kid having a hard time finding like consecutive issues, you know, like you'd find a Fantastic Four and then like all of a sudden you couldn't find another one for a while, and then next time you saw one you'd miss like two issues in between, you know. It was really crappy, you know. And then later on, like I wrote in the comments, I said later on when comic shops came along, as much as there's a love-hate relationship with comic shops, at least I was able to fill in the issues that I was missing if I really wanted them. Cain and Abel by Sergio Aragonés, if I really want them really bad. Well, he said that he sent me a link to he's a big Charlton fan, Charlton horror fan. He sent me a link to somebody videotaped a convention lecture or whatever on Charlton Horror, that was in Charlotte a couple of years ago or a year ago or whatever, and you know, one of the comments that one of the guys made on the dais, like the Charlton, you know, big time Charlton guy, I think he put out a new magazine called Charlton Arrow, was that Charlton comic books with all the short horror stories or whatever, they were made for the casual reader. That's why the horror stories work for a lot of people that didn't either have the time or money or the interest in getting like a book, you know, like every month or whatever. You could go to the store, oh, I want a comic book, pick up a Charlton, and boom, beginning, middle, end on every story and stuff like that. Whereas a Marvel, you had like, you know, here's another like multi, you know, Fantastic Four three-parter, and what was happening to us, we'd buy an issue and we would miss another one, and then we'd miss another one, and then we'd like, oh, what happened to the story? It was almost until years later. So, you know, there was a lot of people that were into the comics that were like just into just reading a book. You know what I mean? And I never really thought about it, but it makes a lot of sense.
DC Comics didn't continue; they were always completed.
I thought they had continuing stories.
No, well, DC's. Not the older ones.
The 70s ones did?
I think they started doing that in the 70s. But
yeah, in the 70s.
In the early 70s, they didn't continue. They,
I thought I remember some of the Tarzans had two-parters. And, I mean, you might be right.
They might have. I didn't read
maybe
those.
Maybe not the Superman.
And I think
Flashes.
The Jack Kirby books were continuing.
But he
came from Marvel.
Yeah,
It seemed like when some of the Marvel artists and writers started coming over to DC in the mid-70s, that's when it was changing more. But when I was a kid, and I've said this a lot on the show, that it irritated me because I'd find an issue of Thor or, you know, Submariner or something, pick it up, read it, not really know what was going on, and then it didn't finish. It's like, next issue, you find out, what? You know, and
Yeah, it happened all the time because I think, I could be wrong, but when you went to the spinner rack, maybe they had two copies of a book, if that much. So if you picked up the one, that's it. FF is gone from the spinner rack. Now you got to go get something else. You know, whereas in a shop now, you know, a lot of shops only have one left now, but, you know, they have two or three.
Well, that was the issue, too, was you go to your convenience store, 7-Eleven or something by your house. And then you'd ride your bike to another one. And sometimes my parents would get mad because I rode for a long time. It was a hard ride.
To get to a convenience store?
Yeah, to another one. You know, I'd go to the couple by my place. And sometimes we'd drive by, I'd see these convenience stores, and I'd pray to God that they'd stop and I could go in and look at one. You know, but it was, you were trying to hit as many stores as you could because every store had something different. You know, some of them always had the same thing, Spider-Man, Superman, you know.
Boring, yeah.
But, well, they weren't boring, but it's just that there were some, you know, like I said, you might pick up an issue of something and then not see another one for a long time. Everybody had holes in their collection. And the guys that did have everything complete, they must have gone to every store on the planet. Somehow they were able to do that. And what was the guy, Scott Shaw and Mark Evanier were talking. I think Scott Shaw, the cartoonist, when he discovered Jack Kirby, he was complaining about it. He had to ride the bus to every convenience store in San Diego.
Wow.
And I thought, wow, we didn't have the bus like that when I grew up. No. You know,
and you had to ride the bike.
Yeah, you had to ride the bike, and it was all spread out and everything. And I thought, you know, you'd spend forever just going store to store, going through the racks.
Well, when I was a kid, I was lucky because I remember if I rode my bike one mile in one direction going east, or there was a convenience store. And then if I went in the other direction east from my house, there was a 7-Eleven, so I could do that. And then another mile, and then if I went, and then almost across the street from the convenience store was a movie theater. So I had all my entertainment, like, within a mile. But I guess I was just lucky that my house was, like, situated that close to all.
Well, we had
and a bowling alley, too.
We had a convenience store that was close enough to walk to. You know, it was several blocks. Then we had a movie theater right by that.
But then
there was another 7-Eleven a little bit further, and that was the trip. And then on the other side, it was quite a ways. And that was about it. Oh, there was another convenience store, but you had to cross a really busy street, and it was a little bit further, too.
Yeah.
And then sometimes the grocery store, we had another one in Oklahoma City called Humpty Dumpty.
I remember Humpty Dumpty.
Oh, they had them in Miami?
Yeah.
I guess in the United States, if you want a grocery store, you had to have something that rhymes. Piggly Wiggly, Humpty Dumpty, Super Duper.
I went to Piggly Wiggly too. It wasn't in my area, but I went to Piggly Wiggly and A&P and all that crap. We used to have convenience stores. Some of them were just a convenience store, but we had. Did you ever have Little General?
No.
Yeah, we used to have convenience store called Little General. I think it had Napoleon drawing on it or something like that. You know, they had all sorts of goofy
names. In the Dallas, Texas area, they had one called Howdy Doody.
Howdy Doody.
And it had a puppet.
Another rhyme.
Yeah, it wasn't the Howdy Doody that, you knew on TV. But
yes, more convenience store. Okay, here, let's grab another comic book. Let's do another one.
All right. That's a nice issue of House of Secrets.
A lot about Fredo Alcala.
And I'll tell you, I'm always pulling out. When I was a kid, I'd buy the cover because Bernie Wrights enjoyed it, not knowing who he was, but the covers would just entice me. And then I bought one. It was a woman reading a story, and she was in her bed. It was like all Victorian. And you're looking at her in this big easy chair, and she's got the book put her hands on it. And she's holding her brow like she was just so disturbed by what she read. And behind her was this guy with this crazed look, with these little tiny demon creatures, around his head. And he's looking like he's going to kill her. And then I bought the book for that, and I opened it up, and I said, well, this sucks. I was a little kid, but the artist was different. The artist was Alex Toth.
Oh, yeah.
And it was a great story. But he drew it different than Bernie Wrightson did on the cover. And, he had these impish little creatures around him, and I remember the story started exactly the way that cover showed, and then the woman turned around and saw him and goes, oh, Richard, what is that horrid smell? Why didn't the guy on the cover draw this? I say that, the Alex Toth story was just brilliant, but...
Yeah, I know, that was always a letdown, because you didn't really, you were kind of had your hopes up, and we've talked about before how we always hated... when the cover artist was never the interior artist.
Yeah, and sometimes I don't, but most time I still despise that.
Yeah, Dynamite Comics does that a lot.
But, all right, I just pulled out of the bag Wanted, the World's Most Dangerous Villains from DC. These are reprint books. Now, I had several of these. This is one of my favorite books when I was a kid, but I'm really shocked when I pull an Al's copy out and it looks brand new. Every one I've got, it looks like I tied it to the end of the car and drug it from New Mexico to California.
You probably did.
And but it's set up like a wanted poster you see at the post office.
With a Nick Carty cover.
Yeah, Nick Carty, I think, did most of them. But this one has Wanted the Prankster, who sprung a trap on Superman, and also Wanted the Nightshade, who twined his tendrils around the Sandman and Sandy. So this time, it's 20 cents and you got two stories. The original ones, it had three stories. I remember it had, I got one of them, it was Superman was one story against the Toy Man. I think Batman against somebody. The Flash was against Gorilla Grodd. There was another one where the Flash was against Captain Cold and Heat Wave. I just love those. It was always, like I said, three completely different stories of one of DC's main staple characters.
I forgot what I was going to say, but it was something about comic book prices, and now I know what I was going to say. From 68 or 69 to 72 or 73, I remember comics going for 12 cents, 15 cents, 20 cents, and 25 cents. I don't know if the paper costs went up that much, but I just remember every time you looked, it was like they went up a nickel. And then what the DC was doing was they were giving you for a quarter 100 pages or something, so that was kind of worth it. Wasn't that the giant size, a 25
those
cent?
Are 50 cents.
Were they 50 cents?
Yeah, the 100 pages. Now, what happened on that was the comics were a dime, and originally, I'm told, in the Golden Age, there were 64 pages, which was something. And saying that, this is, the Depression era, 10 cents was a lot of money for a kid. I was just listening to Neil Adams talk. He said one kid normally couldn't buy a comic. A bunch of kids would pull their money and they'd all have the comic to read and they'd all share it. But they continue to stay that way. I know the first issue of Fantastic Four, which came out in 61, it was a dime. And then after that, they went up 12 cents. But when I grew up, that was the price of a comic, was 12 cents. And then I think it was in 1969 or 70, they went up to 15. Once in a while, you'd still see a 12 cent, but that was rare. And but they were 12 cents or 15 cents for a regular comic book. But then It was in a Marvel Comics. It was either Men of Tomorrow or Marvel Comics The Untold Story. They told the story about it, that DC was the one that proposed raising their comics to 25 cents. And Marvel said, all right, we'll do it. You know, all the companies are going to, you know, follow suit. But then DC pulled a fast one, because what they did was they put them out as 25 cents, but it said 25 cents bigger and better, and they put, you know, two reprint stories in the back. Which I thought was greatness.
It was greatness.
And, I mean, you got a news story in the front and then two stories in the back. And I've always said this. I bought that Green Lantern, Green Arrow drug issue where Speedy shooting up on the cover. But what I loved about that, besides the shock value of the cover, was it had a Gil Kane Green Lantern story with the, you know, the Green Lantern Corps, which I'd never heard of. I thought, man, this is the greatest thing I ever read in my life. And all those Jack Kirby Fourth World books, they always had a second story of the Sandman and Sandy, you know, or
more Kirby.
Yeah, more Kirby. And always older stories he did in the back. And but it was always three stories, and it was greatness. And then Marvel didn't do that. They just stayed 15 cents. I guess their annuals were 25 cents. You know, they were bigger.
But and the reprints, too, were 25 cents.
The problem with those DC books is they were thick and they were kind of crummily bound, and those spines would just bust open, you know.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, they never seemed, all those comics I had were just always kind of coming apart. But yeah, I love that. And then that went away, and then next thing you know, all comics turned to 20 cents, which is this time, and all the DC books just went to the 22 page.
Yeah, back to the, you know. And then they started with the 64 pages for a quarter or something like that, or 50 cents.
That changed. A friend of mine, he was my age, but I guess his parents, to get him to read when he was a kid, they'd buy a lot of books. And he had a lot of those Batman comic books from the 60s, early 60s, like mid-60s. And they were 80 pages for a quarter. And they were all Batman, Superman reprints, the World's Finest reprints, which to me was the greatest books on the planet. But DC had those super specials, which we talked about, which were 35 cents. And they had three or four stories in each one. And then later they started putting out those 100-page super spectaculars for 50 cents, which were the greatest comic books under the sun. And but yeah, to me it was just a blast because you get to read all these fantastic stories that, you know.
Didn't you find though that the 100-page super spectaculars, not all of them, some of them, I was kind of put off by the artwork because some of it was old 40s and it looked kind of crude to me. You know, I mean, I was kind of a little bit like, I don't know if I want to get this because this isn't the Batman that I like now. This is like an old fashioned Batman. It looks cartoony and weird.
Well,
and all that.
When I was 9 and 10 when I were getting these, I just thought, I loved the old Golden Age stuff. It was fun. As I got older, I was writing the same thing you were, but I was wanting the newer stuff instead. But when I was 8, 9, 10, I liked the older stuff, and the new stuff, like, I don't know, it's just, you know, it wasn't catching me.
Well, let me grab one more, and then I just grab something from here. This is going to be really fun.
Is that Spanish?
Yeah, it's
okay.
Spanish.
I'm looking at the back. Yeah, that
yeah,
is,
it's really Spanish. Yeah, it's a Flash issue by Irv Novik. And Ink by Dick Giordano, pretty cool. But they used to have these at the Spanish supermarkets and drugstores. This is like DC's Spanish comic books. It's a Flash story with Abraham Lincoln.
Oh,
that.
Okay, I have that one, but I have the English version. Yeah.
Those are funny and cool. I remember
Batman,
El Hombre Murciélago.
What does that mean?
Batman, the man bat.
Oh, Murciélago.
Murciélago? Yeah, Murciélago.
Oh, it sounds better when you say it.
They call it Batman, but it's really the Flash. They just wanted to sell it as a Batman book. There's no Batman.
I had this. I bought this at U-Totem in 1972.
U-Totem.
And
man.
It God, it's the same thing. It The cover is, you have this robot with one wheel at the bottom, and his chest is a TV set. And it's racing through the city, and it's saying extra, El Presidente Abraham Lincoln ha sido asesinado.
Been assassinated.
Yeah. And then the Flash is there with Iris, and the Flash is staggered. He's in his uniform. Everybody else behind him is all dressed up in, you know, Buck Rogers style clothes. And he says, impossible. SDSLNO 2972.
It's impossible. This is the year 2972.
And then, listen to me try to read Spanish.
It's actually año, but whatever.
And then, on the bottom of the robot under the video, it says, Las Noches en Vivo.
Oh, yeah, I have to read that one.
It was on the American comic. It's something about TV, TV monitor or something, video monitor.
Okay.
But what always blew my mind was over the Flash's head was Adam Strange flying with a jetpack. And I.
That means on Noticias en Vivo, live news. The news of
live news. But and I think it's what it said in the United States. But I kept thinking, what is this guy in the red suit with a jetpack? I've seen him before. I didn't really know who Adam Strange was at the time, but it's Adam Strange. And I kept thinking he'd be in the book, and he wasn't. And then kids would see my comic and argue with me that was Flash Gordon. I said, Flash Gordon doesn't look like that, and he doesn't have a jetpack. And then later when I was reading the Adam Strange books, and somebody on Facebook posted this cover and said, why is Adam Strange in the back of this? You know, I don't know who drew it, but I guess Herb
Novick.
But what I found strange about this time was Iris, Flash's wife, was from the future.
Oh.
I never knew that. I don't know how it worked because he met her here and she was just a regular woman. But there were times where they'd get on that cosmic treadmill that he had and he'd, you know, bring her and see her parents in the future. And maybe, I don't know why they were there, but anyway, this issue started with him bringing her to the future, the year 2972. And they were so upset that President Abraham Lincoln was just assassinated. And kind of find out, I guess they cloned him, because he's such a good president, that they made another one. And I don't remember the whole story.
check out the cover that says, like, see, Batman presents Flash. You put Flash really little and Batman really big, you know? It's like, yeah.
Well, Batman's huge, you know?
Yeah, he was like a big shot, I mean, but it's like, this cover looks like it's...
And everybody knew Batman from television.
This cover looks like it was Murphy Anderson inking. It might be inking Carmen Infantino. I'm not 100% sure, but it definitely, it sure looks like Murphy Anderson. And it looks like Infantino, because Infantino always had that low perspective, you know, what I mean? Where everything was like from, like, looking from above or whatever. But the story by Carrie Bates and Herb Novick and Dick Giordano, but there's a backup by Infantino and, let's see, Murphy Anderson, yeah.
I loved Irv. I never liked Irv Novak very much. To me,
I do.
I think he's good now, but I always put him in the same as Dick Dillon. You know,
He's a little bit. Yeah, I agree.
He had the chops, but I'll tell you, Carmine Infantino, I absolutely loved him, especially that old Flash work he did. To me, is some of the top. But when he became the top dog at DC. I know he would sketch out the covers. You know, he was the one laying the covers out for everybody. He knew what he was doing, but I don't think he really drew. And then when Jeanette Kahn let him go at DC and he went to Marvel, he did Spider-Woman, and I bought every one of those.
You liked those, huh?
And I did, but at the same time, his artwork got really wonky.
He got looser, and the anchors weren't good matches with him.
No, he got wonky. And when I say that, Steve Ditko did the same thing. Steve Ditko just kind of stopped trying to draw. I mean, it's a stylized thing, but it just got to where it was just too crazy. He was too loose and too not trying to draw from life, just, you know. But Carmine Infantino, he was doing, I think, a Doctor Strange that they ran a Marvel fanfare. And I'm thinking, he's just lost the plot. He's just gotten too comfortable and too stylized. But they say that when he went and was drawing the Marvel books, he was out of practice at drawing all the time.
Oh, okay.
But
he lost his chops a little bit.
But those old Batman stories he drew, you know, and especially the Flash, they were really something, you know.
He did some stuff for Warren Comics. He did a lot of short stories, a good chunk of short stories for him, made by a lot of different guys, like Rubenstein and maybe Giordano and Dan Green and people like that. So he had a little bit of a renaissance when DC like let go of him. But yeah, I mean, it just got sloppier, I think, with Marvel. I don't think the anchors were complimentary to him, you know? I mean, they were good anchors, but they didn't, you know, it didn't work. It didn't look as good as that stuff did, but he's an interesting stylist. You know, he actually changed. I read somewhere where, like, in the 40s, he was kind of like one of those guys that was a Milton Caniff kind of style artist. But he, in the 50s, he actually went to art school and refined his style to what it became. So he actually, like, you know, went and changed things, and he kind of had that nice interest. He's an interesting stylist as far as comic book guys.
Well, he was very, very stylish. And at one point I liked it, and then later I don't know, it just didn't seem like he was trying anymore. It just seemed like he was just kind of going through the motions, just to me anyway.
Yeah, the whole thing about trying is also probably has something to do with deadlines too, you know what I mean? When they got to crank out more in order to, like, pay their bills, so they just go at it with a little less effort and a little more, you know, like, you know, hey, business, you know, let me get this done. Yeah, this is acceptable. Let's get it. Let's let the inker do his job on it, you know what I mean?
And that's, I think, when you're talking about inkers, I think also you're an inker and you're getting some penciler and it's not his best work. He's not putting effort, and that's, you know.
You know, you're going like, hey, you're going to get, like, a Carmen Infantino. Oh, yeah, Infantino. Oh, my God. And you look at it and you're going like, this is really loose and sketchy. I don't know how I'm going to do this, but I'll try my best, you know. And then, you know, it turns out that it is what it is, you know. I mean, back then when there was more of that collaboration, it was good and bad, but I think in general I would take it because it was always, there's something interesting would happen every once in a while, you know, like a Bill Everett would ink somebody or, you know, or somebody off the wall would ink somebody and go, wow, that's kind of cool, you know, Kirby and Everett or Kirby and, like, you know, whoever, you know, I can't even think of a name right now, Joe Rubenstein or Kirby and this guy, that looks kind of interesting. We said do more work together. Now, maybe not so much.
You know, every time you see Bill Everett, I just always kind of, I guess to me, I've always looked at him as an unsung hero. When I say this, I was one. When I was in college, like I said, huge Barry Smith fan, huge P. Craig Russell fan, and, I was reading an interview with Craig Russell, and he said that he was an assistant to Bill Everett.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's he was cool. Assistant. And he said one thing that got him was some Conan pages came in for Bill Everett to ink, and Barry Smith had written some notes that I guess there was Conan was facing some king or emperor. He was kind of this fat, lazy guy. And he was just looking at Conan. This is so Euro-barbarian. And Barry Smith drew in his arm a vein kind of popping, like a muscle popping. And Barry Smith drew it, but he just made a note to Bill Everett that, you know, I'd try to show that. And that was all he said. But Bill Everett inked it, but he said, Craig Russell said, that's one thing I thought about as far as storytelling was little details. Like, there was no explanation, but when that, you know, King said, are you a barbarian? Like, showing he had no manners. And Conan was showing self-control. He was standing there, and he kind of, his muscles clenched a little bit, but, you know, he just, you know, showed respect in that. So basically, the King was the barbarian. Conan was the civilized one. And I just remember Bill Everett was, he was the one that created the Submariner, wasn't he?
Sure.
And then he just continued on. You know, he came back to comics, and when he came back to comics, he wasn't doing what we just talked about with some of these other artists where they just got kind of sloppy and lazy. He improved.
Now,
as a kid, I didn't care for his Doctor Strange's Submariner work. I mean, I do now, but at the time, I think one thing that bothered me was everybody had high foreheads and widow peaks, even the women.
They look like they have Submariner heads.
Yeah, they all look like they were losing their hair, you know, which I'm guessing maybe Bill Everett was, but he had this tight, deep style, you know. It's kind of like a forebear to Frank Bruner, what, you know, Frank Bruner was putting out, but Bill Everett, every time you say his name, it's like my heart kind of skips a beat in a good way. He's kind of a unsung hero that basically influenced a lot of people, and, you know.
Well, he died in the 70s, so he didn't live long enough to reap all the accolade that he would have gotten if he would have lived a little longer.
But I've never seen bad work from him. You know, I've never seen work that...
No.
And there are other people we always talked about. And to me, that's the highest praise when I say you've never stopped being good. And there are people, but there's a lot of people that I deeply love. Dave Cockrum. Dave Cockrum, when he first came on, the Legion of Superheroes work, it's second to none to me. Some of the early Marvel work he did, especially when he embellished stuff like the first issue of John Carter, you know, and he drew a later issue of John Carter. Terrific stuff. But in the early X-Men work, I liked. But after a while, it just started getting, you know, especially when he came back after John Byrne left.
You didn't like his X-Men work?
Oh, the after Byrne, no. It was sloppy and bad. It was fourth-rate Dave Cockrum to me. You know, he would show some of what he had, but, you know, I know part of it was he just couldn't keep up with the monthly book.
That's what I was going to say. He wasn't a speed demon either.
No. And also, other people are inking him. To me, Dave Cockrum inking himself was the best.
I liked the way Joe Rubenstein inked him. I really did. Rubenstein was a really good anchor back then. He could really make people's work look.
I do like Joe Rubenstein. Nice. What did he ink on Dave Cockrum?
X-Men.
Did he?
Because
I always knew Bob Wiechek inked Dave Cockrum.
He inked some, but Rubenstein inked some. They're real nice. I really liked them.
It's when he came back, first I thought, well, sorry John Byrne was leaving. I said, hey, I like Dave Cockrum. But I think I bought one, two books, and then I stopped.
Did you like the Paul Smith after that?
I bought those. I wanted to like them more than I did.
Okay.
Now, Paul Smith, I saw other work he's doing. He's drawing Nexus, which is pretty good. But he had a series with somebody else called Leave It to Chance.
I remember.
That was awesome.
Wasn't that marionette in that, or a puppet was in that, or something like that? I seem to remember something with a puppet in it. I could be wrong.
It might have been. I just bought the first four issues and loved it. And then what happened, the comic store I went to, they said one of the customers was desperately trying to buy the first four issues of Leave It to Chance. Well, the guy knew I had them, but I found out a trade was coming out. And I was thinking it would be kind of nice to get rid of the single issues and get a trade. So I said, I'll tell you what I'll do. If you can give me the trade, I'll bring this in. Okay. I got the trade, gave him those issues. And then they did another series of Leave It to Chance. I remember the cover had frogs. This is like 97. And I didn't buy it because I'll just wait for the trade.
It came out.
And I think it came out, but I never saw it. And later I saw there was three trades, but they were a different format than that first one I bought. And Anal Retentive Me, I just never bought them. But what I liked about Leave It to Chance, it seemed to me like Paul Smith was drawing his style. It was a little more stylized than trying to draw like Steve Rude or, you know, a Marvel style or anything. It was still there, but it seemed to me like he kind of found his voice and what he wanted to draw.
He was an animation guy.
Yeah, he came from animation.
A lot of the guys that are kind of like stylists in the last 20 years, not all of them, but a lot of them have come from animation. And, you know, like, you know, what's his face? Darren Cook and Bruce Timm and all those guys.
I love both those guys.
Bruce Timm, I think there's a new DC animated
video.
DVD that just came out.
I think it's called Justice League Gods and Monsters.
Yeah, that's it. My friend just got it.
Yeah, I haven't got it. I'm going to. I like Bruce Timm a lot, but I saw parts of that and I heard what they're talking about. It's Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman. You know, basically the trilogy. And their Trinity. But Superman looks more like Bruce Wayne with a Van Dyke, you know, mustache beard thing. And he's just wearing a business leisure suit of the future. Batman's a lot different. He's got kind of like armor. And Wonder Woman, she's got like some, it's kind of like a white Big Barda suit. But I don't think they're the same characters they are here, but they're, it's a different world, and I guess some of the characters are different. It's some big story, but I don't know. It's kind of neat. But I've heard people carry on about it that bought it, so it's really good.
Yeah, it's out now. My friend just got it the other day.
Yeah, it came out, I think, last week.
So So, you know, look out for it and, you know, all that good stuff. Huh. All right, well, anything else?
No, I think we can stop here.
Call it a day.
Let's call it a day. Sorry, it's just, I don't know, we're not on our game today.
I enjoyed the show.
So it was fun.
I'm not apologizing.
Well, it's fun to be with your friend and hang out and talk, but I don't know about listening.
No, I think it'll be fine. You always say that.
Yeah, I always think that.
You always say that.
Every time Alan and I do a show, I'm like, oh, God, what a disaster. And I always tell Dowd, look, you need to listen to this and make sure you edit it. And then it comes out, and I might try to listen to it. Oh, it's actually not bad. It just sounded like a train wreck when we were doing it. But
oh, well.
Anyway.
Lead us out.
Well, anyway, that's it. Try to stay dry. In the meantime, read more comics.
You can find Al's other podcast, Slow Robot A Go-Go, Dallas' webcomic, The Mighty Blue, and Al's blog, Destination Nightmare, on the sidebar of our blog at bunchofdorks.com.
And click on the Cyclops!